Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. I hope you all had a good Father's Day weekend and that you're staying cool as this extreme heat wave continues across our region. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll have a recap of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony last week before the Senate Intelligence Committee and some new information that's emerged after he testified that casts doubt on the truthfulness of some of his statements. Then, from Public News Service, hear how the president's budget could impact the middle class. Plus, learn what a new report reveals about Donald Trump's recent earnings. In local news, we'll have details about several proposals to help the homeless that San Diego County supervisors will consider this week. On Tribal Beat, learn about a lawsuit involving a Native American church that's arguing it should have the right to sell marijuana and other hallucinogens at a shop in East County. The federal case pits religious freedom against the rights of landlords and drug enforcement laws. From the Iraqi Chaldean community, we have two major stories today. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit seeking to protect Iraqi Americans who have been detained and ordered deported back to Iraq, where they fear death and persecution at the hands of the Islamic State. We'll also have news about a local Chaldean chamber of commerce that's lost a trademark dispute with a rival chamber from Detroit. And then from Public News Service, here's some disturbing facts about how California ranks regarding the well-being of children. On our sports report, Liz Alper will bring you news about some Aztec players from San Diego State University who've just been drafted to play on Major League Baseball teams. With temperatures in triple digits, we'll have some tips for you on how to stay cool this week. And on the second half of our show, we'll be re-airing our interview with Mark Jorgensen, the former superintendent of Anza Borrego Desert State Park and author of a fascinating book about desert bighorn sheep. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. Attorney General Jeff Sessions testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee last week, calling any suggestion that the Trump campaign team colluded with Russia to rig the U.S. presidential election, quote, a contemptible lie. Sessions also denied any inappropriate meetings with Russians, but he repeatedly claimed fuzzy memory. He said he could not recall meeting Russia's ambassador during a reception at the Mayflower Hotel. After his testimony, The Week published a photo of Sessions speaking with the Russian ambassador at the Mayflower Hotel. Also, a Russian lobbyist told British media that he attended multiple meetings that were actually hosted by Sessions, casting serious doubt about the integrity of Sessions' testimony. Sessions refused to answer any questions about conversations with President Donald Trump regarding the investigation or any possible discussion of pardons, citing a Justice Department policy. But under grilling by California Senator Kamala Harris, Sessions was unable to name that policy, to confirm whether it exists in writing or whether he reviewed it before testifying. Despite being a seasoned prosecutor and former U.S. attorney, Sessions showed obvious discomfort from the onset, fidgeting in his seat and averting his gaze frequently during his testimony before the committee. And during intense questioning by Harris, he admitted feeling nervous. The Attorney General drew heat for his firing of FBI Director James Comey just one day after Trump tweeted about his dissatisfaction with the investigation that Comey was conducting. Sessions fired Comey despite having recused himself from any actions related to the investigation into Russian hacking of the election or any possible Trump team ties to Russia. Sessions defended the firing, however, citing a lack of discipline by the FBI director. He insisted that a fresh start at the FBI was the appropriate thing to do, and he complied with Trump's request to submit a written recommendation justifying firing Comey. Sessions added fuel to the fire for those who have asserted that he was complicit in obstructing justice through his firing of Comey. Some have likened the Comey firing to the Saturday night massacre during Watergate, when President Richard Nixon fired his attorney general and another top Justice Department official who refused to fire Watergate special prosecutor Archibald Cox. Back then, Solicitor General Robert Bork ultimately was elevated to the attorney general position, and he fired Cox. Cox had sought White House tapes that ultimately were released, proving that Nixon covered up the Watergate break-in, leading to his resignation after impeachment papers were drawn up. Media reports have suggested that Trump may be considering firing Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. Asked about the special prosecutor, Sessions voiced confidence in Mueller, a Republican who has assembled a team of top investigators and prosecutors with expertise ranging from investigating Russian espionage to prosecuting organized crime and obtaining convictions against Enron executives. Besides questions raised over the Russian investigation and possible obstruction of justice, Sessions' testimony brings up another curious point. Sessions headed up Trump's foreign policy team during his campaign, but he admitted during his testimony that he could not recall the team holding any meetings. He added that he never even met some of the people on the team. That revelation raises questions as to just who, if anyone, Trump relied upon in the U.S. for foreign policy advice prior to the November 2016 election.
Welcome to the Weekend Newscast for June 17th, 2017. I'm Veronica Carter. Here's a look at what we're covering. Senator Elizabeth Warren warning President Trump and his Republican allies are going to deliver a knockout blow to America. How much money has President Donald Trump made since he won the election? We'll have a report. In the news today, a fiery Massachusetts U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren is warning that President Donald Trump and his Republican allies are going to deliver a knockout blow to the nation's middle class. Liberal icon delivered comments Friday night to a packed theater in the heart of Manhattan's Times Square. It was the last stop in a national book tour. She read from the book, The Fight is Our Fight, The Battle to Save America's Middle Class, before exciting the overwhelmingly liberal crowd with rhetoric that demonstrated her appeal as a possible 2020 presidential contender. She has downplayed interest in that, and she didn't address it Friday night, but it was on the minds of many in the audience. Of the Trump agenda, she said, fighting back matters. President Trump's Washington hotel saw almost $20 million in revenue during its first few months of operation. That period coincides with Trump's election and the inauguration as the 45th president. His resort in Florida pulled in millions of dollars more than it had previously. Those details are included in a financial disclosure that Trump submitted Friday to the Office of Government Ethics. The document provides the first snapshot of the Trump organization's finances after its longtime leader became president. I'm Veronica Carter for Public News Service, member and listener-supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Board of Supervisors will look at ideas designed to help get the homeless into homes. County Supervisors Ron Roberts and Diane Jacob unveiled the three initiatives to spur the building, renovation, and acquisition of affordable housing and stem the growing tide of homelessness. 7 years ago, the county launched Live Well San Diego to boost the wellness of residents in our region. Now, county leaders are looking to jumpstart affordable housing. One idea is to create a $25 million investment pool to fund affordable housing. Another is to transfer $500,000 from Roberts' Neighborhood Reinvestment Account to the county's Health and Human Services Agency to underwrite pre-development and planning activities. Supervisor Diane Jacob says it's a hand up, not a handout. She adds that it's important to help people get off the street and help people from becoming homeless, especially seniors. Supervisors will also consider using 11 county properties to help the homeless. Over 9,000 people are homeless in San Diego County, up 5% over last year, according to the Point in Time Homeless Count done in January. The biggest spike was in downtown San Diego, where homeless soared 27%, while homelessness in East County rose by 3%. Supervisor Ron Roberts concludes, "We are trying to make a difference." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Rebecca Williamson.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's Tribal Beat. A Native American religious group is heading to court over a dispute with a landlord in El Cajon over sale of marijuana for use in hallucinogenic sacraments. The Reader reports that a lawsuit, Rizuki Family Trust versus Oklevueha Native Indian Church of Sacramental Healing, Inc., filed by the Rizuki Family Trust, claims that they leased space to the church group in unincorporated El Cajon for a grocery store. The lease states that the premises would not be used for sale of controlled substances, including marijuana. But the defendants began selling marijuana anyway, which they contend is for religious purposes. The unlawful detainer case, originally filed in state court by the landlord, has been moved to federal court. Judge Gonzalo Curiel must now decide if the unlawful detainer would prevent the group from practicing its religious rituals. The church's website states that participation includes teachings of Native American ceremonies, including Vision Quest, a sweat lodge ceremony, vision translations, a sacred wisdom circle, plus optional plant medicine and fire walk. The site makes clear that membership is not limited to Native Americans, but is open to anyone to join. It further states, if you desire to be blessed by having access to Native American ceremonies and sacraments, including but not limited to peyote, San Pedro, ayahuasca, magic mushrooms, and cannabis without legal interference, you will want to consider joining Oklevueha and connecting with our medicine people. Issues at stake include whether freedom of religion and Native American sovereignty includes freedom to sell otherwise controlled substances, including to non-Native Americans off-reservation. A federal court decision could have impacts beyond California, where use of medical and recreational marijuana is legal, though sale is subject to local restrictions. Also at stake are landlords' rights. Can a property owner legally refuse to rent to a church that the landlord finds objectionable, such as a satanic cult, or simply any religion that conflicts with one's own beliefs? Judge Curiel is no stranger to deciding tough or controversial cases. He's the same federal judge who ruled against Donald Trump in finding that Trump University defrauded students.
Coming up next, the Chaldean Corner on East County Magazine's radio show, bringing you news for and about our region's Iraqi Chaldean community. A class action lawsuit has been filed against the federal government seeking to halt deportation of Iraqi refugees back to Iraq. The American Civil Liberties Union filed the complaint against Immigration and Customs Enforcement after ICE agents arrested at least 114 Iraqis, including many who have been in the U.S. for decades, in raids throughout metropolitan Detroit last weekend. Although many of the detainees were picked up for minor offenses in years past, the vast majority have been fully compliant with their conditions of supervision and have had no further run-ins with the law, the suit contends. The lawsuit seeks protections for over 100 Chaldean Christian detainees, as well as other religious minorities, including Shiite Muslims, Kurds, and Yazidis, who could face persecution, torture, or death at the hands of ISIS if they are returned to war-torn Iraq. The lawsuit is a collaborative effort between the ACLU and the Minority Humanitarian Foundation. According to a press release sent by the foundation, which is based in San Diego, home to over 50,000 Iraqi Chaldean Christians as well as Muslim refugees from Iraq. Carrie Moss, executive director for the ACLU of Michigan, states, "Not only is it immoral to send people to a country where they are likely to be violently persecuted, it expressly violates United States and international law and treaties. We are hoping that the courts will recognize the extreme danger that deportation to Iraq would pose for these individuals. Our immigration policy shouldn't amount to a death sentence for anyone," Moss adds. A press release sent by the Minority Humanitarian Foundation calls the federal suit the only hope to protect the safety of the detainees from being sent back to Iraq, where a travel warning from the U.S. State Department is in effect due to the dangers. A recent UNICEF report revealed that ISIS, or the Islamic State, has been using children as human shields. ISIS has also been brutally slaughtering religious minorities since the onset of its incursion into Iraq. The suit claims the detainees' right to due process has been violated by the Trump administration actions, which also run afoul of the Refugee Act, the Immigration Nationality Act, and the Convention Against Torture. Mark Arabo, president of the Minority Humanitarian Foundation, says President Trump has placed a death sentence for the Christians that currently face deportation to Iraq. Many of these individuals have been here for over 30 years and were convicted of low-level crimes like drug possession or failure to pay child support. We cannot reintroduce them to a genocidal war zone where they will undoubtedly be targets, he says. The detainees include a mother of three children who committed only a minor misdemeanor many years ago, and an Iraqi man left partially paralyzed from a seizure that he suffered during his arrest by ICE agents. Arabo says, "We look forward to the day this suit sees the light of a courthouse, so that we may begin the long road to recovery for our community." The arrests come in the wake of a recent deal between Iraq and the United States that removes Iraq from the list of Muslim-majority nations whose citizens could be prohibited from coming to America under the executive order signed by President Donald Trump. In exchange for being removed off that list, Iraq agreed to accept Iraqi nationals who were deported by U.S. immigration officials, a sudden reversal of a long-standing policy against repatriation. The negotiations are part of White House efforts to convince courts to permit the president to impose his controversial ban on immigrants from six Muslim nations. Federal courts have ruled that ban illegal after the ACLU sued to challenge the executive order. The latest lawsuit was filed on behalf of Iraqi refugees from Detroit who were taken to detention facilities in Ohio far from where they had been living. But the suit applies more broadly and could bring protections to other Iraqis detained in other states, potentially including here. The lawsuit asks the court to issue a temporary stay blocking deportation to Iraq without first providing the detainees an opportunity to establish a likelihood that they would suffer persecution or torture if removed to Iraq. The court is also asked to find that the detainees are entitled to protection against such dangers and that attorneys for plaintiffs be provided access to the detainees and documents on their cases. In addition, the suit asks the court to order the petitioners freed from detention unless it's determined by an impartial adjudicator that they would be a danger of flight risk, and also to return all detainees to the states where they resided before they were taken into custody. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has issued an order canceling the trademark for the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce name. The Trademark Trial and Appeal Board held that the trademark caused confusion with the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce based in Detroit, which has been using that name since 2001. El Cajon Councilman Ben Colasso founded the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber and served as its president until stepping down earlier this year to avoid conflicts of interest after his election to the city council. His wife, Jessica, now serves as president. Further complicating matters, the state of California suspended the nonprofit corporation registration for the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, which Colasso has said he's changed to a sole proprietorship. Now, ownership of the group's nonprofit registration has been picked up by Lena Cherry, an attorney who has tangled with Colasso in multiple past suits, including prevailing in a prior fraud suit based on an unrelated business matter. Cherry sent a cease and desist letter in April to Colasso demanding that he drop any reference to the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber as a corporate entity or nonprofit. Adding to Colasso's woes, now the Detroit-based chamber has announced that it has formed a new chapter, locally titled the El Cajon Chaldean Chamber of Commerce. Further, in a press release sent to the media on June 12, James Alia, spokesman for the new El Cajon Chaldean Chamber of Commerce, announced the organization's decision to, quote, oppose Ben Colasso in his standing as a representative for Iraqi Christians as an elected official in El Cajon. Chamber leadership voted on the decision in the wake of new allegations regarding the Miss Middle East pageant organized under Ben Colasso, the release states. As we reported last week, the dethroned pageant winner filed a civil suit accusing Colasso of withholding part of her prize money, running a fraudulent pageant, and posting doctored photos on Instagram of her face on someone else's nude body before stripping her of her title. Colasso has denied posting the photos and said the beauty queen was dethroned because she failed to fulfill requirements in her contract for appearances and posts on social media. But Alia called Colasso's actions toxic, adding, recent allegations concerning the merit of his beauty pageant, as well as personal spats with various women leaders in our community, has resulted in our opposition to Mr. Colasso and his future candidacy in El Cajon. ECM has contacted Colasso for comments on the trademark issues, the rival new chamber and Aaliyah's remarks, but he has not responded. We also asked what this means for the future of the San Diego Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, which is still using that name on its website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
California has made major strides in getting kids insured, but still ranks only 37th in the nation for overall child well-being due to persistent pockets of poverty, according to the latest Kids Count report out today from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Researchers found that across the country, employment is very low at 4.5%, and 95% of America's children now have health insurance, mostly thanks to the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. But Kelly Hardy with Children Now says the huge cuts proposed in the GOP health care reform could erase a big part of that progress.
I could not be more concerned about what's going on in D.C. related to health care, and there would be direct and devastating impacts for children's health in California. The big cuts to Medicaid are what would be the biggest problem.
Nearly 55% of California's children are on Medi-Cal, as Medicaid is called in this state. In the report, California ranked 9th in children's health and was the most improved in getting kids insured. For that, Kelly credits the passage of the Health Care for All law, which extended Medi-Cal benefits to undocumented children in the state. The California budget does set aside a chunk of money for early childhood education, but Kelly says she's hoping for more in the ongoing budget conference committee negotiations because the state ranks 38th in education investment and has 17,000 fewer kids in subsidized child care compared to 10 years ago. Laura Spear with the Annie E. Casey Foundation urges lawmakers to use this data to inform their decisions.
Economic stability for families is really important for kids' well-being in looking at their long-term development. It's about having access to the basics for families so that kids can focus on what they need to focus on, which is healthy development and going to school.
The report also found that parts of California are still struggling to recover from the recession, with the state ranking 46th in economic well-being for kids. Almost 2 million, or 1 in 4, of California's kids is living in poverty. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Liz Alpin with an Aztecs MLB draft report. San Diego State pitcher Brett Seaberger has been selected in the 10th round of the 2017 Major League Baseball draft by the St. Louis Cardinals. The senior left-hander was the 304th selection in the draft, which concluded the second of 3 days on Tuesday. Aztecs catcher and relief pitcher C.J. Saylor was also drafted by the Cardinals on Wednesday on day 3 of the draft. Seaberger earned All-Mountain West first-team honors and was named the Conference Pitcher of the Year after compiling an 8-2 record with a 4.27 earned run average in league play. His overall statistics included a record of 10-3 along with a 4.53 earned run average. His win total led the conference, and his overall ERA was second best in the Mountain West. In addition, he finished 5th with 69 strikeouts, and his .281 opponent batting average ranked 7th. Seaberger earned 2 Mountain West Pitcher of the Week awards during the 2017 season. His first honor came for his performance at Fresno State on March 25th when he tossed 8 innings of shutout ball and faced one batter over the minimum in the win over the Bulldogs. His second Pitcher of the Week award came after throwing 7 1/3 scoreless innings versus New Mexico on April 28th, allowing only 3 singles. He was involved in 3 of SDSU's 5 shutout victories this past season and appeared on the watch list for the National Pitcher of the Year award presented by the College Baseball Hall of Fame. Also taken on day 3 of the draft were Aztecs reliever Marcus Reyes, who was drafted in the 40th round by the Toronto Blue Jays, and left fielder Tyler Atkinson, who was drafted by the Los Angeles Dodgers.
This is Miriam Raftery for East County Magazine and KNSJ with some important safety tips. With temperatures expected to reach 120 degrees in San Diego County deserts and over 100 in local mountains this week, county health officials are reminding the public to take precautions to avoid heat stroke and other heat-related illnesses. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county public health officer, says that even short periods of exposure to high temperatures can cause serious health problems. Doing work or physical activity outside on a hot day, Spending too much time in the sun or staying too long in an overheated place can cause heat-related illnesses, including heat stroke, exhaustion, and cramps, she said. To avoid heat-related problems, health officials recommend these steps. Stay in an air-conditioned area during the hottest hours of the day if you can. Wear light, loose-fitting clothing. Drink plenty of water and avoid alcohol and sugary drinks. Don't wait until you're thirsty to take in water or other liquids. Take cool showers to cool off. Never leave a child, elderly person, or pet unattended in a car. The inside of a car heats up quickly, acting like an oven. An infant can die in as little as 15 minutes, even on a mild 75-degree day. Avoid unnecessary hard work or activities outside during the heat of the day. Avoid unnecessary sun exposure and wear a wide-brim hat if you have to be in the sun. Avoid using your oven to cook and heat up your kitchen. Know the signs of heat stroke or exhaustion. An extremely high body temperature of 103 degrees or more. Dizziness, nausea, confusion, and headache. If someone around you shows these signs, call 911 and begin cooling the individual off by moving them to a shaded area, spraying with cool water and fanning them, placing them in a cool shower if they're alert, and monitoring the body temperature. Elderly people, 65 and older, infants and children, and people with chronic medical conditions are more prone to heat stress. People with elderly neighbors should check on their well-being during extreme heat. People who do not have air conditioning in their homes can go to a public place, such as a shopping mall, library, or senior center, called a cool zone. Even a few hours spent in air conditioning can help your body stay cooler. Do not rely on electric fans for cooling if the temperatures are more than 90 degrees. The county operates a Cool Zones program and has designated more than 100 air-conditioned places as cooling centers. The sites are identified with a light blue polar bear Cool Zone logo. For a list of Cool Zones near you, call 211 San Diego or visit coolzones.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, people-powered radio, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Mark Jorgensen. Mark was the longtime supervisor of the Anzabrego Desert State Park. He is a biologist, and he is now the author of a book on bighorn sheep called Desert Bighorn, Wilderness Icons. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me today.
So tell us a little bit about your background studying bighorn sheep through the years and how you got interested in this particular topic.
I started actually in my teens and visited Anzabrego very often. I grew up in above El Cajon in Fletcher Hills, took every opportunity I could to get out to the desert where I found a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. And bighorn sheep just really grabbed my mind, and I was totally intrigued by an animal that could survive in such a harsh landscape.
Yeah, they are amazing, the way they can just scramble up a steep, rocky face and survive on so very little water in such a forbidding environment out there. And they're beautiful, beautiful creatures. So how many of these desert bighorn sheep do we have left today, and are they endangered?
In San Diego County now, we're at a very high level, probably higher than we've had in 40 or 50 years, we think.
Really?
Probably over 600 in mm-hmm. San Diego County. And the population that we study is called the Peninsular Bighorn in the Peninsular Mountains from Palm Springs to the Mexican border. Yep. And we feel there are probably about 1,000 Bighorn in that group now.
Okay, and does that include, there are also some of these in northern Mexico, correct?
Correct. Baja California has quite a few distinct populations. One population now that we think is derived from a core population in Carrizo Gorge has now repopulated the area around Interstate 8 and Mountain Springs Grade, and we've documented through radio telemetry those animals crossing the border into northern Baja.
Very good news. So in the entire world, which basically the southwestern areas here and northern Mexico, how many peninsular bighorn are there on the planet?
Well, desert bighorn, which peninsular are a subspecies of, we estimate now there are about 31,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that's probably the highest population we've had throughout the Southwest and northern Mexico in probably 75 or 80 years.
That's very good news. Now, how many of those are the peninsular subspecies that we have here in San Diego's East County, out in Borrego and so forth?
About 1,000 within the United States, and then probably another 1,000 of that group in Mexico.
Yeah, so there's only 2,000 of them. So even though the population has increased, would you say this is still something that we should be very concerned about, making sure we don't take missteps that could imperil these animals?
Exactly. We have an increasing population in 7 U.S. states and 6 states within Mexico. These animals, desert bighorn, were extinct in the state of Texas. They were extinct in 3 states in northern Mexico. Now, through a lot of very diligent efforts, they've been brought back.
Nice.
They've been transplanted, but we can never be really too cautious. We have to understand what caused them to go extinct in some of those areas in the first place and make sure those things don't happen again.
Right. So what are the biggest threats to the bighorn sheep locally here in San Diego and Imperial counties, as well as northern Mexico?
The biggest threat we have overall in the Southwest has been diseases derived from domestic livestock.
Ah.
We don't have a lot of that in our local desert areas, although we do still have signs that we have some pneumonia problems that take out young animals especially. And we're seeing certain canyon areas, certain subpopulations that are really having trouble rearing their young through that first summer.
Is there anything that can be done to protect them from that?
We have been trying to work with interagency groups and with ranchers, livestock operators, to make sure that we have no domestic sheep and no domestic goats anywhere within bighorn sheep habitat.
Yeah.
Now, one issue about our animals crossing the border now into northern Baja is the lack of controls in Baja with livestock operators. So these animals that spend much of their time in California could cross the border, make contact with domestic sheep or goats, and turn around and bring those disease agents back to their herd mates back in California. And really, those things can spread very rapidly.
Right. Now, the border issue is kind of a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? Because on the one hand, they can get exposed to diseases down there. But on the other hand, they have historically crossed the border back and forth seasonally for water sources, maybe food sources. And how is the border wall? We hear a lot of talk these days, Donald Trump and others, about let's just wall off the entire border. A good portion of it already is here in San Diego County. How is that impacting the bighorn sheep here?
So far, we have held off the triple fence and the high walls within bighorn habitat in San Diego and Imperial County. We need to really monitor that situation. When you look at the entire border, Arizona, New Mexico, California, you have to be concerned about many large mammals that have been crossing that border for hundreds of thousands of years. Jaguar, pronghorn, and bighorn. And
can they get through or over the wall that we have out there in East County? It's not real big, or is it just a matter of only after it ends out there somewhere around Jacumba?
Correct. The fence currently ends at Jacumba Airport, just east of the small town of Jacumba. And then there is no fence through the rugged bighorn sheep terrain all the way to the desert floor.
Yeah, very rugged mountain areas, rocky mountains out there.
So we would like to see that status maintained where there is a large gap through the most rugged terrain. There are some human trafficking issues there, but it's not a main thoroughfare. It's not very welcoming to human foot traffic. Certainly vehicles can't make it through there at all.
Yeah.
The idea that some government officials just want a gigantic wall and without any consideration to hundreds of thousands of years of wildlife corridors.
So do very many people really manage to get through that very, very rugged section? I mean, if they were to have their way, these officials, and wall that section off, obviously would have a huge negative impact on the sheep. Is it really doing much good in terms of, you know, keeping undocumented immigrants or whoever they're worried about from coming across the border there? Or is the terrain so rugged that it's pretty well accomplishing that on its own?
In my opinion, it's not worth it. They have double and triple fencing down along the Tijuana border from the ocean inland Otay, and people still manage to climb that and go through it and under it.
Yeah, tunnels.
And now there's discussion about the Carrizo Railway being reopened.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly you're going to have a causeway of movement of people and drugs through there.
Yeah. What about the drought that we've had for the last 5 years, which certainly is easing somewhat now, but how much of an impact has that had on the desert bighorn population, Mark?
All forms of wildlife are going to depend on good winter rains and good spring green-up for the forage, whether you're talking about insects or reptiles or small birds. Certainly bighorn depend directly on spring vegetation green-up. And even though people thought this was an El Nino year, 2015 and 16, we still registered a little over half our average in Borrego Springs and in the desert region. So the drought is still in full swing. In order to have young survive, the females are going to have plentiful green up and nutrition in order to produce milk. And we have, you know, a significant number of lambs being born. Probably 80 to 90% of the females do give birth.
That's good.
But then we have very high mortality rates in late spring, early summer.
Is that because of lack of water here or disease or other factors that we'll be getting into in a moment?
Yeah, it's very complex. So it's multiple factors. We can't just pin a very complex problem down to one or two simple solutions,
yeah.
But we do know that it works in combination.
Do predators take very many of the lambs, mountain lions, eagles, anything else, coyotes?
Mountain lions are the primary predator of bighorn sheep in our area. In the 1990s and early 2000s, we documented fairly common predation by mountain lions on bighorn sheep.
Mm-hmm. Which are protected now from hunting and shooting. So,
right. And you know, you'll have two sides of that controversy as well. People that think mountain lions are in trouble and cannot be taken, and other people who think that if you took a great number of mountain lions, it would allow bighorn sheep to just spring back magically. Doesn't really work that way. We've seen high predation levels suppressing bighorn sheep, and then when environmental factors reverse and we start getting more rain, more green up, we saw the sheep population rebound, and the mountain lion predation backed off quite a bit.
For centuries, the local desert bighorn sheep have had to contend with primarily natural cycles of drought and rainfall and predation and so forth, and then later the introduction of domestic sheep into their territory. But in recent years, we've also seen an influx of development of various types, everything from golf courses to, you know, resorts, and most recently these massive scale green energy projects, the desert wind projects, industrial scale wind projects and solar projects. What kind of impact are those projects having on the desert bighorn, and in your opinion, does that threaten their potential for survival over the long term?
It is a great potential threat, and it's a real threat in the big developments that have already been constructed. Many times these things are sited out in the desert, and I think society feels that put them out in the desert, they're out of sight, out of mind. And with government support, unfortunately, they've been put into some very valuable wildlife corridors.
So, yeah, I remember that you told us at one point about a report that the Anza-Borrego Desert Park folks were trying to prepare that would be voicing concerns about the Ocotillo Wind Project when it was proposed, when there were hearings going on that the federal government was holding on that, and that wound up being suppressed. Did that report include concerns about the impact on the bighorn sheep of this wind project, which shared a 5-mile, or does share, it's been built now, a 5-mile border with the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park?
Correct. And, you know, we've had state and federal government support of these mega industrial projects, whether solar panels or wind generation. And we have provided testimony at many of these meetings prior to construction, pleading with these organizations to consider wildlife concerns. And unfortunately, the government in large part has swept our concerns under the carpet. And in the case of the wind generator plant, when asked their opinions, the park folks unfortunately had to say they didn't have opinions. The government, state government, had told them to basically put a muzzle on it, and they didn't want state employees who really knew the situation on the ground countering what Governor Brown had approved.
Yeah, and the federal government, I think, shares some blame here, too. I know that they inexplicably delisted that entire project site and said it was no longer critical bighorn sheep habitat, even though everybody out there said you see bighorn all the time. It took our photographer exactly one day, when I asked him to go document bighorn sheep on the project site. He documented, I believe it was 11 of them, 11 or 12, standing there on the site. There was GPS on the photo, ear tags, tracking tags on these animals. Absolutely no question what they were, where they were, when this was taken. And when we sent this to the Secretary of the Interior, Salazar, his response was to order the issuance of take permits, allowing the wind developer to inadvertently kill up to 11 or 12 sheep, however many were actually shown in our photograph, rather than doing anything at all to protect them. And then after the project was approved and built, you know, despite all this evidence, you know, people out there told us they quit seeing the sheep for a long time, and then when they dropped the big blade off and had to shut it down for 3 months, the sheep came back for a while and then left again when the project was powered back up. So it just seems like there's a lot of evidence, if they just open their eyes and look at it, to see that it's impacting, at the very least, the migratory ability of the sheep to move through this area, whether the actual noise or infrasound, you know, may also be impacting them, who knows.
And one of the towers was allowed, as you said, under a take permit to be placed right in a bighorn lambing area where we knew six bighorn females traditionally came to the same spot that they felt was safe.
Wow.
And so there was a take permit provided for six females and six lambs. And this is just not how our society should operate. When we are armed with good scientific information, we should step back a little bit. I mean, they started that project with over 200 wind turbines, and they ended up with 117.
Yeah.
So to go to 115 or 112 or whatever to accommodate bighorn lambing would have been really no net change for that operation.
Yeah, which is worth noting. It has underproduced ever since it was built. It has yet to ever meet its capacity factor that was promised all 3 years. It's come in substantially.
So what these projects do is you cut off bighorn movement here, you cut it off over there, and what that does is it fragments the bighorn habitat, where in prehistoric times we had free movement of animals from one mountain range across an open valley to another mountain range all the way into Baja. Now we have fragmented this into islands of habitat.
Yeah.
And we have Interstate 8, Interstate 10, wind farms. When these projects are allowed to be built within bighorn habitat, whether it's a border fence or a canal or a wind generator plant, one after another, whether it's a border fence or a highway or canal or a golf course right up against, you know, into a canyon, these things preclude bighorn free movement, which they've had for hundreds of thousands of years. And it creates islands of habitat instead of an open, what we call a metapopulation, where animals can move in response to drought, disease, large-scale fires. Mm-hmm. They have a lot more resilience in a large swath of habitat.
Yeah, I would think the islands could also contribute to inbreeding over time. I mean, you need a healthy population that's large enough to keep a healthy gene pool, right?
It could. We have studied that, and we found out that since rams do move long distances, as far as 75 or 100 miles,
wow,
it doesn't take too many incursions by a ram to do away with that inbreeding concern. But in the long term, you've created these small islands of habitat, and they become much more vulnerable to whatever natural or human-caused catastrophe might beset that habitat.
Now, I've heard some talk about creating special wildlife overpasses on freeways. That's been done in some other countries. Tell us about that and whether that is something that could be helpful to our local bighorn population.
It definitely could, and we've been studying it for about 20 years, and it's about time that we took action on that. Interstate 8 is a prime example. We have animals crossing four lanes of traffic almost daily.
Wow, yeah, I've had readers send us photos of that pretty regularly.
And we've had quite a few animals get killed, and we know that it's happening. We have a water source adjacent to the highway, and as this population has expanded, which has been a good thing, the numbers have increased in that southern population from a group of about 30 back in the 70s and 80s to over 200 now. So that's all a good thing, but that means that you have to provide this historic habitat, you know, in high-quality fashion.
Yeah.
And I-8 was widened in 1963. During construction, there were bighorns seen every day, and for about 30 or 40 years, they were absent from there.
Wow.
Now they're back. They're getting hit by vehicles. There's probably, you know, many tens of thousands of vehicles a day.
So what would it take to get one of these wildlife bridges built?
The state of Arizona built three over on Highway 93 between Kingman, Arizona and Hoover Dam. They've been extremely successful. In the first 20 months of operation, they documented more than 2,000 crossings by bighorn sheep. So these things are, it's a matter of government action, and so these wildlife overpasses, really, the science is out on them. We don't need to study it anymore. We need to find out where to build them, and we need government funding. We need the initiative. We need some action to allow these bighorn free movement between these islands of habitat without being struck and killed. It'll also benefit public safety because a 220-pound ram,
yeah,
coming through your windshield,
not what you want,
is a threat to human safety. And so in Arizona, they've completely eliminated motor vehicle accidents with bighorn. We've
amazing.
Had thousands of sheep crossings documented with cameras. Very successful.
Wonderful program. Well, let's hope they can get that going here. Couple of more questions. What are some of the most interesting facts about bighorn that you would like to share with our listeners that you have learned in the course of your many years of research, as well as your wonderful book about the desert bighorn?
Yeah, we put the book together, Desert Bighorn Sheep Wilderness Icon, Jeff Young being the photographer.
And it's beautiful photography, by the way. I highly recommend this book. It's published by Sunbelt Publishing right here in East County, and the photography is just stunning.
We had that difficult challenge of selecting from more than 60,000 photos that Jeff Young had taken, and we put 200 of them in this coffee table book. Our big goal there was to help educate the general public. I think people are fascinated to know that desert bighorn sheep still thrive in San Diego County, mm-hmm, right here where we all live in our backcountry, and they're thriving throughout the Southwest and into Mexico. But our goal was to help people learn more about this valuable wildlife species. And when we hear about potential threats or developments out in the desert, my goal is to develop a higher level of awareness and education among the citizens of San Diego County. So when they hear about a development going in, they can express their concern. And I think once you look at the book and read it, go out and see Bighorn, I feel we all have an obligation to sound the alarms when we hear that something threatens this valuable wildlife species.
So what can people do specifically? Are there particular actions that you recommend the public take if they are concerned about preserving our local bighorn sheep?
I think when they hear about projects, whether it's more solar, whether it's Sunrise Power Link expanding, we hear about golf courses around Palm Springs, La Quinta, that are being notified they have to build fences to exclude bighorn. Border fence, anytime you hear that, the reentry of the Carrizo Railroad into Carrizo Gorge, bighorn will die. There hadn't been a train there in 34 years, and they actually used the tunnels for shade.
Oh, my goodness.
And while the train was operational, I went in and recovered two bighorn that had been hit by the trains. Mm. We know it's going to cause mortalities. So I would just ask the general public to call their legislators, county board of supervisors, and especially if you hear about another large-scale energy project out in the desert, to voice your concerns, come to public meetings, support groups that are doing the right thing, land acquisition, research projects. And we have the Anza Borrego Foundation that supports acquisition of bighorn habitat in
right.
Eastern County.
It's also a good idea, isn't it, to reach out to state and federal representatives, your members of Congress, your members of the state legislature, because so many of those decisions about the desert lands are out of the hands of the local supervisors. The railway, maybe they have a say-so over, but not if it's on, say, Bureau of Land Management land or some of these other places that have been impacted by the big projects.
I saw a piece on the local news TV about the railroad the other day, and I've been following it. I've written stories about it. I've researched it. It is not a moneymaker. It's almost impossible to keep it operational mm-hmm. because of fires, earthquakes, floods, natural disasters, the economy. And all I heard is this is going to be great for international trade between the U.S. and Mexico,
yeah.
and it's going to be a jobs creator. I didn't hear one word about the environment. You know, I'm not going to go out and make a big deal out of it. It's a dedicated railroad, and just let the chips fall where they will. But I predict it won't last 5 years, and it's not a good thing for the desert wilderness or for bighorn sheep. And I think that someone, when they come up with these big ideas, they should consider the environment once in a while.
Yeah, definitely. Just because it sounds green doesn't necessarily mean that it is, with the case of some of these big solar and wind projects and transportation and elsewhere. Now, the public can participate in the annual Desert Bighorn Sheep Count each year. It's in July. It's not for the faint at heart, but tell us about that.
We have been conducting an annual 4th of July Bighorn Sheep Count in Anza Borrego since 1971. And we generally solicit volunteers, mm-hmm. between 60 and 70 of them. And the difficult part for volunteers is they are assigned to a water source that is visited by bighorn sheep, at least we hope is. And they sit there for 3 full days in the shade, a couple hundred yards back from the water.
Yeah, and we might be talking shade when it's 110
it's quite grueling.
Or 115 degrees out there.
Some days they're lucky and it's only 103 or 105. Other days it's 118. So it is not for the faint of heart. And we have a mandatory orientation program.
Mm-hmm. So people want to get involved despite the hardships. You do get spectacular photos if you're a photographer out there. How do they sign up?
They can get ready for the summer of 2017 by sending their name, address, and their email and phone number out to Anza Borrego Desert State Park in Borrego Springs. Attention, Ranger Steve Beer, and he will put those potential volunteers on a mailing list. And next spring, he will notify them all when the count and the mandatory orientation program would be. And they can get involved. We've had people, one individual's been on 44 out of the 45 we've had. Many people have been on 20 or 30 of them in a row.
My goodness. Is there a fascinating fact or two about bighorn sheep you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this interview up?
You know, through the use of technology, we have gained a lot of knowledge in the last 20 years. And today we have not only radio telemetry collars, but we've moved on to GPS collars and actually satellite collars that send info directly to a computer. So we've been shocked to see if some of the long-range movements, especially among the rams. We had one ram that we put a radio collar on down in Carrizo Gorge below the railroad, and he went missing. We searched for him with radio receivers, and we were astounded to find him 75 miles away in the Santa Rosa Mountains.
Wow.
All the way at the north end of the park. He'd gone through about five different mountain ranges, crossed about three or four paved highways.
He really got around.
And during the mating season, they go on these walkabouts in search of females.
Fascinating.
It drove home the idea that we need to keep these mountain ranges connected.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the relationships between our local Native American tribes and the bighorn sheep through the years?
We know through interviews with tribal elders and with a lot of the traditions that are carried on today that the desert bighorn played a very large role in the everyday life of both the Kumeyaay and the Kuya, who were native to San Diego County. We also have found several sites where bighorn were hunted by Native Americans. We find series of rock hunting blinds. So we know they were an important food source. They were also very important, you know, in the spiritual life of Native Americans.
Use the horns and everything.
Yeah. So, you know, and they continue to be valuable to not only the Native American groups, but to people in our society today. We have a lot of folks who gain strength just knowing that wild bighorn are out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And also folks that want to go out. I just met a guy this morning. Had breakfast with him, and he was going out to photograph bighorn again.
Yeah, they're very inspiring. It's such a thrill to see one in the wild.
So we put the name Wilderness Icon in our book because these things truly are a symbol of wild places. They live in pure wilderness and in wild lands, and we would like to be able to nurture those wild habitats throughout America and Mexico.
Well, Mark, it has been such a pleasure having you here. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Mark Jorgensen, who is the former supervisor of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, a biologist, and the author of a wonderful new book called Desert Bighorn Wilderness Icon. You can get that through Sunbelt Publishing right here in East County. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you do to preserve our environment here in San Diego County.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.